47 years ago, on April 22nd, 1970, we celebrated the inaugural Earth Day. And the New York Times cover read, "Millions join Earth Day observances across the nation." Well, closing in on almost five decades later, Earth Day is an international observance, and global sustainability issues are constantly in the news. With us to talk about the significance of Earth Day and several associated topics is a distinguished panel, three individuals who have devoted much of their lives to the environmental, social, and economic sustainability of our planet. First is Liesl Clark, a principal and co-founder of Five Lakes Energy, a policy consulting firm focused on clean energy and the environment, and she is also president of the Michigan Energy Innovation Business Councils. Liesl, welcome.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Second panelist is Chris Kolb. Chris is the president of the Michigan Environmental Council, a coalition of over 70 organizations across Michigan that focus on a number of key areas ranging from clean energy to environmental justice to wise land and water use. Chris, good to have you on again.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And our final panelist, Solis Michelonis, a widely respected environmental attorney in the Bloomfield Hills office of Plunkett Cooney and a regular contributor to Detroit Crane's Business as author of the Environment and the Law blog. Solis, always a pleasure having you on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin a bit deductively here. I mentioned in my open Earth Day. What has it meant over these past 45, 46, 47 years to you in general, and specifically, what do you think it's meant to the environmental movement? And we'll start with Solis.
Well, it seems every year it comes around, it is a reaffirmation of a commitment that the country made back in the early 70s. Ironically, one of the people that started Earth Day was actually my boss back when I first started working in Washington, D.C. at the Solar Lobby. And so it dovetailed along with environmental issues, along with renewable energy, and all these things are now coming to the forefront. It's been a long road, but every year we're reminded of where we started and where we're going.
Chris?
I guess I agree. I mean, it's I do agree. It's a day to put a national and world focus on environmental issues. But for many of us, Earth Day is every day. And the work we do is focused on improving the quality of life for the individuals that live in our state and our country and around the world, as well as for the natural environment. So this is one day that we can all point to where we've been and where we're going and take sort of the temperature of where we're at today and what we need to do for tomorrow.
I appreciate that comment because one of the taglines for this show is it's always Earth Day on Greening of the Great Lakes. Liesl?
Well, I have to agree with what has been said already, but I think an interesting spin on it this year, of course, environmental thoughts have a lot of different threads that run through them. One of those common threads that you explore on the show and that we talk about often is energy. This year is particularly interesting because the legislation that was passed in December, its enactment date is April 20th. And so while energy is only a piece of our environmental conversation this year, I think it's going to take on a little bit more of a highlight because those laws will go into effect. And so I think that that puts an interesting spin on this year's Earth Day in Michigan.
In terms of spins or positive, interesting spins, one or two things from each of you that's been particularly the progress that we have made that for you most significant since that first Earth Day in 1970. Liesl?
Well, I was struck listening to NPR this morning as we were talking about, and I know we're going to go towards the federal conversation too, changes to the EPA. And I was thinking while I was listening to the EPA cuts being discussed on the radio, I was thinking about where the EPA came from. Certainly a part of growth of the movement out of that initial Earth Day, and then how much has been cleaned up and how much progress we really have made around our land, air, and water, knowing that there's still a lot of work to do, so not trying to discredit the amount of work that there still is, but just how far we have come from that first Earth Day.
Chris?
I would say just, you know, looking at the past decade, I think one of the greatest accomplishments is really our transition to a cleaner energy sourced world. And if you look at where we in Michigan have gone in that decade, is we were before 60-some percent of our electricity is being produced by coal-fired plants. That's now closer to 40, and within 5 years, we'll be close to about 25% of our energy coming from coal. That means a huge improvement of quality of life here in Michigan, coal-fired power plants. Besides, there's a climate implications, produce lots of pollution, which impacts human health. And so we will have a huge, improvement on that way. We're seeing our communities around the state adapt 100% renewable energy, goals. And so I think, this is where we've made these huge improvements, and it's not just for cleaner energy. It's also a huge quality of life and an economic driver in Michigan that we are still seeing, improvements every day on.
I think the most significant development is probably the general acceptance of environmental protection. At one time, it was extremely difficult to pass these statutes and the battles that were fought in the 60s and the 70s. But now you have general acceptance not only by the people who want a clean environment, but also corporations. Every major corporation in the world has got a sustainability policy. All of a sudden, the baseline is not whether we should protect the environment, but how we should protect the environment. I think that's the biggest change.
Well, and we were talking before the broadcast, but some of that early legislation was bipartisan. It happened to be Richard Nixon signed some significant legislation in the environmental movement, not maybe because he wanted to, but because there was so much pressure from a bipartisan coalition.
Right, and the environmental protection genre or the history of environmental protection has always been bipartisan. I mean, we'd also discuss Teddy Roosevelt, Richard Nixon. I mean, there was always a bipartisan agreement that something needed to be done. It's kind of ironic now that we've gotten to this point where we have general acceptance of it, there seems to be a pushback and desire to kick things back to the way they were in the 30s and the 40s. I don't think that's going to be successful, but that's one thing we should take away, is that this should not be a big, difficult thing to get through.
Well, that segues into my next question about, we talked about major accomplishments since 1970. What are one or two things that concern you the most? And one of the things that you alluded to, Solace, was partisanship. But, Chris, what are one or two things that are really maybe keep you up at night?
I when I interviewed for my job, they asked me this question, what do you feel is the biggest threat, facing us? And I answered that with the same answer I'm going to give you today, and that's climate change. And, as climate change is happening, our ability to produce food, get clean water, and really sustain life here on the planet is really going to be stretched as we have more and more people on this planet. And if we ignore the causes of climate change, we ignore the abilities to make solutions to it. So in Michigan, the Great Lakes, we are going to be faced with huge threats when it comes to climate change, from agricultural to extreme weather events, dealing with stormwater runoff, heat increases in our major communities. So unless we address it, we are not going to be able to solve that problem. And where I fear right now is that it could be another 4 or 8 years before the United States and the state takes a leadership position. And while we can do things to catch up, we will never get back those 4 and 8 years where we really should be addressing this issue now and today. And I agree, it can be done on a bipartisan basis, but it needs to take someone in a leadership position to put the issue front and forward. And the voters are there. It's just that our political leadership is not there right now, and that's really what keeps me up every night.
And when we're hung up on all of this partisanship, the rest of the world isn't just going to twiddle its or their thumbs while this is going on. Somebody else will emerge as a leader.
Yep.
Lisa?
So I think the thing that really keeps me up at night is working within the state of Michigan and also at a national level, helping people understand change and be ready for change. So, it fits into the idea of climate change. It fits into the idea of this hyper-partisanship. However, I feel like we got to be ready for the change that's coming, and we got to be able to handle the change that's in front of us. So a great example of that is this from a localized discussion is this conversation about smart meters. So smart meters are almost completely rolled out now in both DT and Consumers Energy Service territory. They're rolled out in a lot of our municipals and co-ops, not all, but some. Mm-hmm. Great. Mm-hmm. Smart meters allow us to do a lot of the types of demand response and energy efficiency changes to the home, take advantage of time use rates, but they're change. And so people push back against it because it's change, and I don't understand it. I don't understand how it works, and somebody's going to hack it, and somebody's going to get in my house. And, you know, and so it's this communication that's necessary to be able to get people ready for change, because change is coming no matter what. You know, the only thing we can guarantee is that things will change. And so being comfortable with that. But just for an example with smart meters, one of the things we can do, for example, with intelligent refrigerators is we can shift the defrost cycle. So who cares when your refrigerator defrosts? I don't care when my refrigerator defrosts. It usually, refrigerators run on about 10 watts of energy. However, when they do that defrost cycle, it's 10 to 15 times more power that they use. And so if we can shift that defrost time into the middle of the night when we do have wind blowing, or at the times when electricity is a lot cheaper, it really creates, takes a lot of pressure off the grid and allows us to not have to build future generation. It's enabled by smart meters. It's also enabled by smart appliances. But we can't be scared of these changes. We have to be able to ask intelligent questions and make sure that it fits for our own household. But we've got to be ready for change, and we've got to be able to adapt.
Given this fear of change, which is endemic to the human species, we've got a new administration in Washington. A lot of folks like yourselves are concerned about some of the things that are going on there. We hear about some of the big picture things like EPA, but Solis, you sent me some information. There are a lot of things that are going on in Washington with executive orders and what have you that people might not be aware of that are troubling.
Yeah, so the what's going on in D.C. right now is there's sort of like a three-pronged attack. First, there's Congress. There's something called the Congressional Review Act, which allows them to look back in the last six months of the prior administration and decide whether or not the regulations that were passed during that period of time could be repealed, and they've generally and consistently repealed. So they've repealed Fish and Wildlife Service regulations regarding hunting and wildlife refugees. You probably read about now hunters can go into caves and shoot hibernating bears and things like that. There's also land use planning process Interior Department had put in place. That's also been repealed. The stream protection rule under for the coal plants, that's been repealed. So that's part of it. The second thing is executive orders. And there are certain things that the president can do just by signing a piece of paper. And basically, he's looked back at the previous administration's executive orders and, for the most part, have decided, well, we're going to cut these off back and forth. So, and also, the other things they can do is make orders. So they've ordered the agencies to start reviewing all their regs. And, for example, one of the orders is go back and look at all your regs and see which regs can impede development of fossil fuel development, and then provide us with these recommendations. And you have to do it within like 180 days. So, you know, by the middle of summer, late, early fall, you're going to be seeing all this new stuff coming up. And then finally, the budget. The budget also drives a lot of this. And so the budget being proposed, Congress is the one who actually develops the budget. So the budget that's being proposed, lots of big cuts. But at the same time, that's probably just the first bargaining position, and there's already pushback even from Republicans in Congress.
Chris, your take on some of these things that are going on in D.C. right now with the new administration?
You know, I think they're downright scary. At times, they are short-sighted. And, you know, there's really kind of, for us, a focus on, you know, sort of the regulatory side and also on the enforcement side, because, with you know, one without the other doesn't really work. Mm. And if you look at what the president's been saying and his, you know, rhetoric on regulations, you know, mostly for, you know, aimed at the coal industry, really, you know, like many of the things he says, you know, what he says doesn't really reflect what's going on in the ground. And right. And for the coal, you know, powered, you know, industry, what they're facing is not regulation, you know, overload. It's that the marketplace has changed, and that there's cheaper forms of energy out there. As our coal-powered power plant fleet gets old, 60 to 40 years, you're starting to replace it. where you're not going to replace it with something that costs more when you have, you know, less expensive natural gas and renewable energy sources. So the reality is that the industry is in transition. We're going to cleaner, you know, fuel sources, which is really good for all of us, because also the reason we have regulations is to prevent us from pollution. And coal-powered plants produce a lot of pollution that harms us. You know, our respiratory systems, our heart systems. New information coming out that the pollution is impacting dementia and type 2 diabetes. I mean, so things are, it's real, there's a health situation there. But the other thing is that if you cut funding for enforcement as well, then the good actors don't see the benefit, and the bad actors are the ones who are able to pour things down the drain or emit things into the air, and so that just disrupts your whole scheme there. I've always said that, you know, don't look at a politician's rhetoric. If you want to see where their priorities are, look to their budget. And in this budget that's being proposed, a 31% cut to the EPA budget, 25% reduction in employees is going to have dramatic impact on environmental regulations in this country. And here are just a list of some of those areas that are being, you know, really chopped. The Clean Power Plan, climate change research, hazmat cleanup funds, state grants that help to protect on air, water, and hazardous waste programs, and research and enforcement budgets being slashed as well. The biggest example for us in the Great Lakes is pretty much the elimination of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which has helped to, you know, clean up old toxic hotspots around the Great Lakes. You know, really help to fight invasive species in the Great Lakes and to improve habitat so that our fishes, our fish industry and fish habitats are really good and healthy. Huge implications. And yes, there will be pushback from Congress, but we know the money won't be completely restored. Right. And so there's going to be a reduction. And those type of decisions are really going to impact people here in Michigan and across the country. And they're not something to really turn a blind eye to and hope that the process, you know, is going to take care of it. We need to be all involved and engaged in really pointing out why these dollars are so expensive and now to allow any attack to go unfought.
Liesl?
Yeah, well, I think I just need to underscore what's already been said. In particular, from Chris's recent point, you know, it's very unusual to be in a position where the administration's budget doesn't set up for the programs to support the programs going forward, right? And so then you're going to Congress to have Congress put the dollars back in. It's very unusual situation to be in, and I think that it's foolish to think that they're going to get fully refunded through Congress and to rely there. But we do, I agree, we have to be talking to our congressional representatives and telling them how important these programs are. But it's just we found ourselves in a very unusual situation, and it's tough to see the path forward. That being said, as I pointed out before, change is always coming. You know, Chris made a couple of points about market forces that I think are important. Right after the election, like the week after the election, I was at a conference in Detroit hosted by General Motors that was about 350 companies that are interested in purchasing more renewables. So it was a smorgasbord of companies from Walmart to Kohl's to manufacturers like GM, Ford was there, our utilities were there, all of them coming together and talking about how do we get more renewables. In the course of that discussion, they did one of those polling systems where they put a question up and everybody in the room answers the question, right? And so, again, the situation is it's a week after the election. The question to the purchasers of renewable energy in that room from the corporates was, do you think that the election last week is going to change your path forward? And the answer was overwhelmingly no. Market forces have changed so much. And again, to underscore what Chris said about change in prices around energy technology. You're not going to replace coal plants with coal plants. Like, it's just, we're not at that point from a cost perspective. And so the market forces are such that we're going to see these things continue to move forward from a renewable energy deployment perspective. Now, that being said, changes at the executive level have a very dramatic impact and, you know, for lack of a better term, trickle down across the country. So I'm not suggesting that these forces at the national level are not really significant, because they are. However, it's interesting to see how much the market has changed from an advanced energy perspective, and there is absolutely momentum there.
Well, that, and I want to throw out a general question here because that's a nice segue into it. I mean, given where the world is going, given where young people are now, given different majors, given positions like vice presidents of sustainability at major corporations, I mean, how much can a four-year administration really impact directional truth when it comes to sustainability? And Saul?
Well, the way business works is they make investments, and they look, these investments are considered over the long term. So the investments that were made 2, 3, 4 years ago look ahead 10, 15 years, and they've already made those investments. They're not going to change in midstream. They've already invested the money, they've already invested, and you can do everything you can to try to stem that tide, I suppose, but it's inevitable. And, you know, the interesting thing is that they're also going to be seeing what's happening overseas. The current president has no power over what's going on overseas with respect to that. And basically that development, all the technology we developed will be then manufactured, used, and serviced by people overseas. And at the end of 4 years, if we come back to where we are now, instead of having a mature industry in place, we'll be buying our stuff from overseas. So that's something people need to think about is, you know, do we want our technology? We want to be buying back our technology. We want to pay for someone in France to operate our technology because we don't have people here. And I think industry sees that, and that's what's happening.
Chris?
You know, I agree. I think that the long-term, you know, outlook is good and improving, but the immediate impact can be really detrimental, especially at the local level. And that's where I fear. I also fear, as Elisa mentioned, of the states, you know, imitating what's going on in the federal government. So as we're seeing these huge proposed cuts in the federal budget for environmental protection, we're seeing that as well as the state. As the state committees have proposed, you know, slashing some dollars out of the Michigan DEQ budget, environmental protection. And those have implications on the ground for communities who do face these battles every day. Some of us live in areas where we have really, you know, good air and good water. But a lot of communities that don't, and then the issue of environmental justice, where some, you know, some communities have an over, you know, burden to bear of the environmental consequences of our modern society, and we need to be able to bring resources to those communities, you know, today and address those issues today because they're not going to go away. We have huge legacy issues that need to be taken care of. We look at the issue of lead, whether it's lead in soil, lead in paint, lead in water. We need to be addressing those issues, you know, up front today. And if we delay, that's just more children who are exposed to air and water pollution who need not have to be exposed and whose future is impacted negatively by our inability to move forward today. So when I think about these issues, I think about the kids who are impacted, the infants, to young children, to the elderly who also are impacted more so than you and I. So we need to think about the affected populations and what we can do today. And so reaching out to legislators and decision makers, we have to talk about the opportunities of investment, what business is doing, and also on the impact of communities of not moving forward.
Liesl.
Well, it's an interesting yin and yang when you think about it, right? Because there's so much that our corporations do because of the regulatory structure that's put in front of them, and that if we're in a world where some of that regulatory structure isn't going to be there, what will they continue to do is an important question. I am excited about how it does seem like businesses and corporations have shifted. So, for example, my company, Five Lakes Energy, we just became a certified B Corp. There are about 20 certified B Corps in Michigan, many of them located on the west side in the Grand Rapids area. Some names you would know, like Cascade Manufacturing and others. And it's a certification process that looks at people, planet, and profits, basically. So do you treat your employees well? Do you take care of your waste? Do you, you know, consider where your input streams come from? Do you think about purchasing local? And that's an exciting exciting thing, and I think it's great that there are different companies thinking about that. I was just at a restaurant last night in Howell, where I live, and they had a big sign on the wall talking about their commitment to employees, their commitment to their waste streams, and I thought, you know, it's great to see how these things are moving. Now, you never know to what extent some of these things are just marketing, but on the flip side, I'm pleased that our marketing's going that way. Like, that makes me happy. But I do think it's a yin and yang between the regulation and the regulatory structure, creating the right framework for cleanup and for making sure that we're not doing additional harm. And then it comes also from bubbling up from the businesses and what they want to do in order to be good corporate citizens.
Let's take a look at a couple of hot buttons right now, environmental hot buttons in the state of Michigan. Let's start with line 5 and the report that's coming out in June and how your organizations may or may not be engaged in that. Solace?
Well, I don't represent any organization. I represent clients. But you know, as they say, all politics is local, right? And ultimately, you got to figure out how you're going to govern yourselves and make your world a little smaller. In terms of line 5, though, it's interesting to see there's a what hasn't been discussed is there's all sorts of pipeline projects across the United States that are happening right now, and there's a huge pushback. And just what was it? Just last week, the XL line in Canada burst. Right, and so this is the XL line that's going to be going through the Ogallala water aquifer and all that sort of stuff, and so we have a pipeline underneath the straits, which is everybody says the absolute worst place for any sort of leak to happen, and it's very, very old. So we've got these brand spanking new pipelines that are failing. So the question is what's going to happen to the old one, and why are people confident, to the extent they are, that it's not going to happen? And I think the burden would be, it seems to me, on the people that are saying, yeah, don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm. Chris?
Yeah, you have a 60-year-old pipeline, you know, running through the Straits of Mackinac and the Great Lakes. If there is a spill, you're not going to be able to clean it up. The current is too strong. In the winter, you know, forget about it. So the huge risk is there. You know, anything 64 years old, is going to have problems, stresses, and strains.
I can testify to that.
It's probably. I wasn't going to make any comment about age.
I can testify to that.
Right. Now, but it's probably lived out. Mm. It's, you know, life expectancy. Mm. And so plans have to be made as to what are we going to do. So the two plans we're looking at is, you know, what are the alternatives to a pipeline through the Mackinac Straits? And, you know, what would be the risk, you know, in worst-case scenario, so we know what resources we need to have on hand to address it. But the fact of the matter is that we can no longer ignore this issue, and we have to make a decision. We can't kick this, you know, the can down the road any farther. And so it's time to really say, okay, what is it going to take to decommission this line? Let's get this pipeline out of the Great Lakes and remove that threat once and for all. And, you know, the public agrees with us. I mean, there's no issue that I've found, environmental issue, where you can go to any community anywhere where people don't say, yeah, that's, you know, we really
need
to.
And they say it passionately.
And they say it passionately. And this is an issue that, you know, someone like the Attorney General, Bill Schuette, has agreed that its days are numbered. Well, we say those days are you know, are here, and yeah, we as a state need to make a decision based on good information. But our number one, you know, aspect has to protect the Great Lakes. And all those things that evolve around that. 40 million people or so get their water through the Great Lakes, or drinking water. So it's a huge risk there, and very little benefit, you know, to the state of Michigan. So we need to make a decision and make it soon.
Yeah, I don't know how to underscore it anymore. I mean, what's going on is scary, and I think that were we to end up with an environmental disaster, I mean, just look at all the alarm bells that have been going off for so long, and how do you, you can't clean it up, you know, you can't clean it up. So I think what it shines, the light that it shines for me is on infrastructure and how we've got to invest in our infrastructure. We did a very good job of that in the past, and it's really been dwindling, particularly in Michigan, but nationally as well. And, you know, you look at things like updating our grid and look at some of the storm events that we've had just in the last few months, and you think, you know, obviously tree trimming is part of it, but it's not all of it. You know, we need to be doing more around smart grid. We need to be doing more about hardening our distribution infrastructure. When you go down, we shouldn't be down for as long as we are. We should have better controls and technology in order to tell and communicate who's down and who needs repair and reroute lines when possible in order to get people back up. Like the amount, the resiliency of our grid is very scary. And so I think that this to me reemphasizes the need to invest in our infrastructure and how critical it's not sexy. It's like insulating your house. Who wants to do it? Everybody wants to put in the granite countertops. But we've got to be investing. You know, we just saw that transportation report that came out maybe a week ago. Again, refocusing on how bad our roads are as well. We got to commit to ourselves as a state. We've got to commit to, you know, our children and our education. We got to commit to our infrastructure. We got to put some dollars behind it.
Let's stay with infrastructure for just a moment, Lisa, and we'll go around on this one, too, because that brings up the whole, is there a silver lining to the whole Flint debacle? Because now people are looking at infrastructure that's not above the ground, but the serious state of the infrastructure below the ground as well.
Yeah, well, and, you know, water is critical. We've still got wooden pipes in Michigan, you know, let alone the challenges that we have with lead across the state, particularly focused in Flint. You know, it's a place where we've got to spend time and money, and we've got to do it intelligently. So one of the things that's happening at the Public Service Commission is there's a lot of planning because of the legislation that was passed in December, setting up an integrated resource plan. So there's a lot of planning that's happening at the Public Service Commission through stakeholders. And one of the important pieces that's going to come out of this planning is how to use technology strategically in order to move us forward. Because the thing that we do know about plans is they're basically out of date the day that they're written. We know that's true. We cannot predict the future. We can just enable it. We have so much technology at our fingertips now. If we deploy it strategically and wisely, it can really help us with these infrastructure challenges out into the future.
Chris?
Yeah, I think, you know, having the opportunity to serve on the Flint Water Advisory Task Force, which reviewed what happened in Flint and why, I can say you that, you know, Lisa's point about investing in infrastructure is huge. The water in Michigan alone, it's estimated that we're underfunding our water infrastructure by $1 billion a year. The drinking water side of that is probably up to $500 million a year. We have over 460,000 lead service lines in the state of Michigan, over 100,000 in the city of Detroit alone. It's time we address this situation. And it goes from protecting our source water to making improvements in our treatment technology and distribution systems, and addressing the risk that's in our homes as well when it comes to drinking water. So all those risks that are out there from source water to treatment and distribution exist in your home as well. So it's something that we've got to take advantage of what happened in Flint and the tragedy there, learn from it, and move it out across the entire state. But Flint isn't just a one, you know, community situation. There are over 2,000 water systems in the country servicing over 6 million people who have had high lead situations. Over 600 of those had lead levels as higher than Flint. So we need to be making that investment. And the second lesson to be learned is when you don't make that investment today, it costs you more down the road. And making that investment in infrastructure does drive economic development. We know that $1 invested in infrastructure produces at least $3 of economic development, and every, you know, dollar gives you, you know, several jobs as well. So we know that it's good for public health, it's good for the environment, and it's good for our economy. What better way to spend, you know, a dollar than to invest it in infrastructure?
And Solis, we've got about a minute left, and in the spirit of your profession, closing statement.
Well, my closing statement is I agree completely with the infrastructure thing. It absolutely needs to be spent. The money needs to be spent. What will be interesting is how it will be spent and how it will be arranged. There's a lot of talk in this administration about public-private partnerships. You may see some impetus towards that, and that's good and bad, depending on what the project is. But I think after all, you know, we've talked about all the things that scare us. Earth Day is coming up, and it's a celebration. And we have come a really long way from the time the Cuyahoga River was burning and Lake Erie was dying and what have you. And maybe it's because I'm just an old guy and I remember that stuff. I just encourage people, if you don't believe me, read up and figure out where we've come, where we were, where we are now, and where we can go. That's my recommendation.
Well, this has been a very good Earth Day conversation with our Earth Day panel. A lot of optimism, but a lot of work to do. There's no question about that. The panel has been Liesl Clark, principal and co-founder of Five Lakes Energy, which is a policy consulting firm which focuses on clean energy and environment. She's also president of the Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council. Chris Cole, president of the Michigan Environmental Council, a coalition of over 70 organizations across Michigan that focus on a number of key areas, from clean energy to wise land and water use. And Solis Michelonis, widely respected environmental attorney with Plunkett Cooney, regular contributor to Detroit Crane's Business and author of Environment and the Law, a regular blog. Thank you all so much for being guests on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Always great to be here.